Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? Welcome to the Around the World podcast. I'm your host, Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more in the Around the World podcast. For this episode of the podcast, I sat down to talk with Ryan Campo. Ryan has been staying in my apartment in Beijing for the summer house sitting, and now that I'm back, I got a chance to sit down and have a nice conversation with her about travel. We discussed mainly China, but also many other places in the world, and she, at a young age of 25, is already quite well traveled. I hope you enjoy my discussion with Ryan Campo. Hey Ryan, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Doing great. We just been messing with the audio, and I think we got things working pretty well.
Hopefully
we're all set to get started. Why don't you give people a little bit of background? I mean, you've been living in our apartment for a little while, and what got you there? How did that happen?
Well, I've been living in Beijing off and on for the last 2 years. I first moved here in August of 2014, and I lived with a Chinese family and was working, and went home for the summer, came back, was making good friends with some Frisbee players, and that's how I got connected with Katie and you guys. But I just came back for the summer this last time to, again, work in education, doing the kind of typical expat in Beijing thing, but...
Teaching English, you mean?
Teaching English. But I'll be going back just in a couple days to work on my master's in teaching. So I'm not your typical expat in Beijing in that way. I'm passionate about education. And
oh, you think it's of it as a career? And
yeah, it is.
Yeah, just for, like, background, a lot of people come to China to teach, just teach English, basically, for a year, or sometimes less, sometimes just a month. There's good, really good opportunities here, kind of all around. But you know, Beijing is for me and Katie. It's been awesome because it offers everything that a big city would have. And sometimes foreigners get stuck in small places where they get really lonely and there's no one to talk to.
Yes, before Beijing, I was in a small town in southern France, and I was there because I had the goal originally of living in France, being an English teacher there. I'd studied French for, 10 years or so, and was really passionate about it. But yeah, I was in a small town, and there weren't a lot of people my age, so I mainly hung out with 40-something-year-olds and and little kids. I was an au pair for a family, as well as teaching. So,
that can be a good experience, too. Real cultural immersion. That's kind of like the double-edged sword of being in Beijing. It's like it's really easy to stay insulated from Chinese culture. You have to like make an effort actually to integrate with the culture, to learn the language.
I guess
if you're in a little town in China, you just have to learn the language. What choice do you have?
Yeah, that would be, I think, the way to do it. If you were coming with few Chinese language skills and you really wanted to learn quickly, like that would be, a lot quicker. I was going to say easier, but it's not easy. It's never easy when you throw yourself into an immersive setting like that if you don't have a lot, like even the basics in the language. But yeah, that's a really powerful way to learn a language when you have to.
That can be killer.
But Beijing, like, I lived with a Chinese family, but also Americans. At first, we were a small startup company, and we all lived together, and so we mainly still spoke English. Like, I had the IE, and I had, like, you know, like a family setting, and, like, heard some Chinese, but there was no need from the beginning to really learn Chinese. So, you know, I feel like this summer I've made more progress than the year and a half or so that I was here before, just because, like, I'm closer into the Hutongs. I'm in more of a Chinese neighborhood, so Yeah, the little fruit and vegetable street. Like,
yeah,
it's been great for that. Yeah, just like making friends with the people selling me my daily fruit, and
that's cool.
It's been really neat.
Yeah, our neighborhood's awesome. We just went for a walk in the park like just a couple hours ago, and there's essentially it's like a track around the park. It's like the size of a track course, like 400 meters,
mm-hmm.
with a big park in the middle and a big pond and a lot of trees and bridges but the track isn't built like a racetrack. It's just like a more like a sidewalk, but everybody kind of uses it to go walk in there, and there's usually just a ton of people out and about. There's if you go at sunrise or at dawn, there's people doing like Tai Chi in the morning. And
yeah, dancing. I did that earlier this week.
Did you?
For the first time. I don't know why I wasn't going all summer, but yeah, around 8 a.m. there was Tai Chi in one corner, there was the aerobics dancers in one corner, and there was this crazy sort of like group rhythmic clapping and call and response happening. I wish I could understand what they were saying, because it's so funny just to watch. Like, you gotta wonder, why is everyone just here to clap for, like, half an hour it goes on. They're clapping, and there's a leader saying a phrase, and everyone responds with something. It was really interesting.
That's been one of the most interesting things for me about China, just going to parks and seeing what's happening. I mean, a lot of the dancing they do, it's not particularly complicated, or it's not like a competition. It's just kind of, I think it's just a community thing, just being together with your friends and exercising a little bit, like light exercise. You don't see a lot of people like jogging in Beijing or like doing anything real serious, but just about everyone does a little exercise here and there. And it's just kind of, it's almost changed my way of looking at exercise in some ways. It's just part of your day. Just walk to the park and hang out with your friends and dance a little bit. And it doesn't feel like this grand thing that you have to go do then.
Right, or like forcing yourself to do it, because it's just like what you do to go and be social also.
Yeah.
It's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, although when it gets real polluted, you can't even do that really. That kind of is a bummer.
They still do.
I personally wouldn't, but local people... They just go out.
Rain or shine, smog or clear day. Yeah.
That's one thing that really surprised me here is like when it got really bad, like in November, December last year, when the pollution was super high, very few people were even wearing a mask. Hardly anyone.
No, but then there were the couple days when it was above 300 for like three or more days earlier, and the government did like code red.
Yeah, the red alert.
And then, the red alert, and everyone suddenly was wearing masks. And it was so interesting, because it wasn't that it was super high. It was just the government like announced this is a problem because, so many days consecutively.
Oh, that was when I was traveling in the south of China then. So I was away from Beijing.
That was a really interesting thing, yeah. I think it was connected to a conference happening in Paris at that time that was about the environment, and just Beijing, or the Chinese government, had made that rule at some point that, like, if it's consecutively above 300 or 350 for so many days, we have to go into red alert and declare it. So because there was this conference going on, there was this international pressure. And so that was, I think, the first time I remember them declaring it as a problem. And everybody responded. So many more people wearing masks because the government had sent something. And
so it actually worked then. That's really good.
Kids didn't go to school.
Yeah.
I have not been here really since. I was home from January to June, so I'm curious if it's happened regularly since.
I came back from Christmas in early January, and it was just beautiful here. Like, January and February, there were maybe 2 days of moderate pollution, but nothing really serious. And the rest of the time, it was just blue skies. I mean, it was cold. It's a cold climate, but there's a lot of wind that comes from Siberia, and it just keeps the pollution clear in the winter. So it was actually really nice. Spring was nice. It really hasn't gotten that bad since like 9 months or maybe 8 months.
Right.
I should give some context. So you're kind of talking about like 300. Like, what does that mean? I've talked about this before with other people, but I think it's worth mentioning again. Just the way they measure the pollution level. It's how many. Oh, I think it's how many micrograms of PM 2.5, which is 2.5. Nanogram particle or 2.5. I don't know.
Really tiny particles. Yeah.
2.5.
2.5. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just how much of that is in the air per, like, cubic deciliter, I think. And it, the what it means doesn't really matter, but the number, if it's below 50, it's fine. It's considered healthy. And American cities, I'm guessing, are even, like, notoriously smoggy cities like L.A. are probably usually below 50. And if they get bad, like, on smoggy days, it's maybe 75 or something. And today in Beijing, it's been like 40 all day. It's been really nice. It's hot, but not polluted. But some days, like you were talking about, it's over 300 for 3 days in a row.
Right.
And that's where I think 300 is kind of the boundary between it being kind of bad and like really an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I usually, at least hypothetically, like to wear a mask if it's above 200 because it just hovers around 150 to 200 so consistently here. It's almost like that's the new norm for me, for my standards. But once it's above 200, 250, then you can start to feel it and smell the pollution a little more.
Yeah, you can totally smell it.
Yeah, that's for me sort of the cutoff. But yeah, I remember talking to some of my French couch surfers this summer, and I think they mentioned like, in Paris, it got up to 100 once, and everyone, like, shut down schools. Everyone was warned by the government to stay inside. And that's the kind of thing that sounds comical, even when you're used to living in Beijing. Like, 100's great. If it's 100 here, I'm like, I'm happy.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, like, kind of your context. And like, I was just in India recently, and we were talking about temperature there. And this guy from Delhi, he couldn't believe that if it hits 35 Celsius, which is like, I don't know, 90 or something Fahrenheit, that it's like considered a heat wave. And he was talking about how in Paris, people died when it hit that level. And that's just like an ordinary day in Delhi. That'd be actually like a cool dawn. It would be like 35 degrees. So it kind of, it just depends on where you're coming from and your context, I guess.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, and how is pollution in India, actually, in the bigger cities where...
It's gotten to the point where I think if you look at the top 10 in the world, most of them now are in India. Mm. China might not even have a city in the top 10 anymore.
Really?
They do, it's maybe one of the cities in Hebei.
Right,
One of the factory towns.
Right.
But it's not going to be like Beijing or Shanghai.
Mm.
That said, it still is an issue in China, but they're addressing it, and mm-hmm. I've gone to some conferences about it. It's definitely in the open now. In India, I spent most of my time in the mountains where the air was perfectly clean. It was fine. Delhi seemed to be pretty polluted consistently, but when I looked at my like the app that I use to look at pollution levels, the PM10 count tended to be pretty high.
Mm.
So those are slightly bigger particles. And I think it's probably because there's more factory or industrial pollution there. Mm-hmm. And then the PM 2.5 is a little bit lower. So I think it's kind of hard to even really know, get a really good idea, because you read about like where the polluted cities are, and there's different standards of measuring. And I don't know what the best standard is. And sometimes they're measuring averages throughout the year. Sometimes they're measuring mm-hmm. like the highest it's ever been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of unfortunate. There's not like a quick spot you can just check things out for and really get an actual clear idea on an apples to apples comparison mm-hmm. of various places.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, maybe that's an idea for an app.
Even getting an accurate reading, app I downloaded, I'm sure it's lying to me about the pollution on a day to day basis, because it's looked much worse. Although that's an interesting thing too, you mentioned the two types of particles that the AQI reading is based on, and one of those particles affects the color of the sky, and one does not. So I have a friend who worked in like basically like checking on health, on the health of the air. And she was saying that, yeah, people sometimes think like, oh, the skies are blue, it's a nice day, but that just means that one of the particles is healthy that day, while the other one that doesn't affect the air color is like really bad. And, and it's actually a polluted day. You just don't expect it.
Huh. So it's almost hard. Yeah, it's hard to get a really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of different sources. There's different apps you can use. There's different locations. Like, if you look at just Beijing, there's probably 10 different spots that regularly report what the levels are.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get vastly different readings in places that are like a mile apart, where it probably isn't really that different.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's a good idea. Like, start an app that really improves the reporting on this, and kind of collates it and makes an apples-to-apples comparison. And then maybe simplifies a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, not that I want to do that, but anyone listening, there's an idea. Yeah, I don't want to just talk about pollution all the time.
No.
You came here for the summer, right?
Mm-hmm, yep. Came here to work for the summer, and I thought about putting some travel in on either side, but I actually sort of wanted to just be in Beijing and visit some of the spots I haven't been to on the weekends. And, you know, living here is such an adventure on its own. But yeah, I'll be going back to start a master's program. I'm already starting to get, you know, travel angst, because I'm like trying to plan for next summer so I can still be moving, because it's been about 3 years I've just been living abroad and traveling when I can. So,
well, where are you going to be going to school?
I'll be over in the Seattle area, about an hour south in Olympia, Washington.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Cool. It's a beautiful area, so at least I'll have lots of hiking and camping I can do over there. Yeah,
I mean, like, just before coming to China, the last thing I did was kayaked for like a week down the Selway River in Idaho, which is really a pristine wilderness. It was awesome. And then I caught a ride the rest of the way across the country, across Montana and into Washington, and flew out from Seattle to Beijing. And
sweet.
Yeah, Seattle was like, really a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The mountains there were fantastic.
Yeah, so, I'm excited.
Yeah.
And I grew up on the other side of Washington State, so I've gone over to Seattle to visit relatives every summer. But I'm excited to try living over there and have, much more easy access to all the crazy evergreen forests over there. And the mountains are all along, the Cascade Range is right there. It's really beautiful. So, but I haven't really visited in so much, I haven't visited my own state nearly as well as I've visited France.
Yeah, that's common. That's a common thing. That happened to me, too. And I spent 6 years in the States, like, after traveling for a long time. And a lot of that was just exploring Wisconsin. There's so much to see and do there that I wasn't even aware of.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
That's so cool.
Now it's kind of like China's focus. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you traveled a lot around China?
Around China? A fair amount. I haven't ever gone out west to Xinjiang or to Tibet. I'd like to do that later. But I have done a lot of trips along the more populated range along the East Coast.
Okay, cool.
And including one where Katie and I were in Vietnam, and we took trains from Saigon all the way up to Hanoi. And then she flew back to Beijing from Hanoi, but I took trains the rest of the way. So I traveled from Saigon or Ho Chi Minh City all the way to Beijing by train.
Wow.
Yeah, that was cool. It took like probably like 5 or 6 nights on trains. But I got to see a lot of stuff along the way.
Yeah. Did you stop and get off to explore places or?
Oh yeah. I spent some time, in China, I spent some time in Kunming, which is, has a great climate. It's kind of like warm all year round and just, one of the least polluted cities in China, from what I hear. So that's always good. Then up to Chengdu in Sichuan province. And I saw the pandas. Have you been there?
No, I haven't. I have been to Kunming and Yunnan, but But yeah, I debated about stopping to see the pandas, and I skipped it. I think a lot of people do Xi'an, Chengdu, and then Kunming, and I went Xi'an to Yunnan. So.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, how are the pandas?
Frankly, I wasn't expecting much. I just kind of stopped because it was along the way, but it was awesome. It was like, I could just watch those guys all day. They just chomp on bamboo and down. They're really loud, like the chewing noise.
Oh,
it's really a loud crackling noise.
That's funny.
And they just sit around and eat bamboo all day. And I think it's probably the only animal that you can never be sure that it's not really just a guy in a panda costume. Like, yeah, pretty much any other animal you see, if it's a guy in a costume, you know it right away.
You can't tell with a panda?
I guess when they're eating, you can tell. You can tell because you can see their teeth.
Sure.
But they don't look real. They just look like some guy in a panda costume.
That's hilarious.
So I always try to convince people when I show them my pictures that's what it really was. But they never believe it.
Nice.
But it's so hilarious to watch them. Definitely I'd recommend it. And they give the numbers, like how many pandas there are in the world, and it's not many. It's like a few hundred, and a huge percentage of them are right in Chengdu. I don't know the exact amount, maybe a third or something like that of all the pandas in the entire world are there.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, very cool spot to go. What else did I do? I went to Jiujiaigou National Park.
Mm.
That was beautiful. I'll have to show you the pictures later. There's all these lakes that are like turquoise, and they have actually a wide range of colors. So from turquoise all the way to red, just from the sediments in the water and from the rocks below the lake. Mm. It's just stunning. And you can, like, the park starts in lower elevations and then it goes up pretty high. So when I went, it was like maybe early March, and so at the bottom everything was pretty warm, and then by the time we got to the top, it was the lakes were iced over still. There's all these mountains in the background and waterfalls coming over these mossy cliffs, so it's really green with the water flowing over them, and it's just really beautiful place.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
And almost completely unknown, I think, outside of China. I maybe saw like two or three foreigners all day there. And there's thousands of Chinese. I mean, it's a really popular spot for Chinese tourism.
Yeah, yeah. Whereabouts is it?
It's north of Chengdu.
Okay.
Probably like 7 hours by bus.
Okay.
North of Chengdu.
Okay. What you're describing sounds like a place that my roommate visited. She used to work for a travel company here in Beijing, and so she was my roommate, kind of in quotation marks, because she was always leading these student trips around China. And so, yeah, she this one might have been just her, but she has visited so many amazing places, and yeah, this sounds familiar. She takes these places to her travel experiences there and turns it into a comic book. She had beautiful pictures of, like, multicolored.
Oh, she draws, like, pictures?
She draws, she draws
them. She sketches stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, like, traditional Chinese artwork often depicts these places. And, like, we have a painting in our apartment that's from near Yangshuo with the karst rock formations, and that's, like, a really traditional Chinese painting. So it's, maybe she's kind of taking up that tradition or putting her own little twist on it.
Yeah, maybe. That's so cool, yeah. You guys have some beautiful artwork, mainly from your travels, places you've been to?
In the apartment?
In the apartment, yeah.
Yeah, we got an old map of Beijing, or Katie bought it. She found it in some shop, and it's from, I think it's a German map, and it's from about 100 years ago. And it shows like what Beijing looked like at the time, and in some ways it's obviously completely different because the city is just blown up in size just over the last couple decades. But you can definitely see the major landmarks. You can see right where we live, and you can still see the Lama temples on there, and like the Forbidden City, all the big tourist attractions that were around 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the one piece of artwork. Then We just have a few photographs. We kind of decided to make one wall of our apartment into, like, the Great Wall photographs.
Yeah, yeah.
We've gone there a bunch of times. Have you gone there?
Yeah. I just went a couple weeks ago again.
Did you?
Really great.
Which sections did you go to?
I went to a village. Shoot. It was past Badaling a little bit, so we had to catch, like, the train, the same train that everybody was taking to get off at Badaling.
Yeah.
We continued into a village. I think it was called Yanqing, maybe. But then we got picked up by a family and taken to their little farm location.
Mm.
That was really cool. So we stayed overnight. They cooked us really delicious, like, farm fresh food.
And then
they took us to the, like, entrance to this hiking path to get up to the Great Wall. And so we just hiked up there and,
walked along
the wall for a little bit and came back down. Got lost. You know, ended up on the other side of the Great Wall, like, saw another village, and met a nice Chinese woman who also spoke English, and, you know, made a phone call for us to get picked up again.
Okay.
So it all worked out. It was fine. But we kept joking that, like, we crossed over the Great Wall, like, who knows if we're now in, like, Mongolia, or, like...
Yeah, right,
like,
you never know.
Where are we now?
What kind of army's gonna march on you?
Yeah. But that's cool, so that... Is that a photo that you've taken?
Yeah, it was with my mom, actually.
Cool.
We went up to Jianko.
Okay,
Which is, you know, it's surprisingly close to Beijing. It's like maybe an hour and a half away from here. But it feels like the middle of nowhere. And you just hike up to the wall. And it snowed that morning, or that night before. So we couldn't even get a bus back to the city because the bus wouldn't run because it was snowing.
Mm.
Yeah, and we ended up having to hire a taxi for a lot more money, but it was still worth it.
Totally.
And it was just like no one was there. I mean, we were putting the first footprints in the snow on the Great Wall.
That is so magical.
It's really a special thing to see.
Yeah.
Especially considering they don't get a lot of snow here.
At least
not in the city. Yeah. Even though it gets cold.
Mm-hmm. That wind. That was the first time I went to the Great Wall. It was a windy December day, so we also were pretty much by ourselves. There was one little group, funnily enough, like this Santa Claus, man dressed in full Santa Claus regalia, was walking the Great Wall with some Chinese people, but he was from France. He was hired to come over as this French Santa Claus to sit in a hotel, and they took him out to the Great Wall as Santa Claus.
God, I wonder how he got that gig. I'd like to have that one.
Well, the story was he is known as a Santa Claus in, like, northeast France. Every winter he has this little house up in the mountains and he decks it out and it's like his, you know, people come and visit it and he's like a Santa Claus, like, figure. So
he's like a professional Santa.
He's a professional Santa.
I guess I got a ways to go before I tick that one.
Yeah, right?
But, like, jobs like that are so cool. Like, you just... I don't know. I met this guy once who... he was in Taiwan, and like, I think it was Universal Studios or one of the film companies just approached him. He's this big, like, tall, good-looking white dude, and he was walking around Taiwan, and they said, hey, do you want to be Captain America? And he had this just stand there. He just put on his costume and stand there and not smile and just, like, be stoic like Captain America is and do that for, like, 4 hours. And just the amount of money that they paid him for 4 hours of work, he could live for, like, a month.
Jeez.
I mean, it was, like, some crazy amount.
Wow.
I mean, it's like, damn, how do I get that?
I know, right? Just have to be in the right place at the right time.
That's right. Yeah.
My coworkers too, I've got two coworkers. They're a married couple and they have two children, a daughter like 7 and a little boy, I think 4. And he's a cute little boy. And my coworker was telling me about, you know, how they're just walking around Beijing and all the time somebody will walk up and say, like, "Oh, like, we want to do a photo shoot with your son, like, we'll give him clothes, we'll pay him this much money, like, show up here at this time."
Okay.
And she's done it, and she's, like, made a huge profit off of her son, as well as, like, she and her husband go to do voice recordings all the time, and it's just, like, so silly, though, to, you know, have someone just walk up to you on the street. she was sure it was a scam too, but they showed up and did this photo shoot. I think it was for a watch, and so they sent the little boy home with the watch, as well as the outfit that they dressed him up in, as well as a ton of money. So, hey.
Hey, I guess it works. I guess I just gotta get out there more and walk around.
There you go. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I just look too goofy for these ads or something.
I'm not
a little boy either. There's actually a kid. One of the teachers that works at Katie's school, or used to work there maybe, her son is on a bunch of posters around the subways. And so like 2 years ago when we first moved here, at least, maybe not anymore, but we were getting off the subway and like, oh, hey, you know so-and-so? I'm like, yeah. And like, oh, that's her son. And then I started seeing his face all over the place. And it was the same kind of thing.
How funny.
Just in some ad for, I don't know what company it was even. But it's kind of just hilarious how that can happen.
That is. There is a like photo shoot up in the one of the subway stations I always get off at to go to work, and it's not even attractive. Like there's an older, like a 40-something year old guy holding a thing of coffee, like two kids who are making kind of like scared faces, but they're all white, and it's I don't know how this happens. You don't even have to be necessarily too attractive or a good model, and yet like there they are for the last 2 months. Like, I see pictures of them every day. It's just goofy.
I'm gonna have to get into look into that.
Yeah.
Maybe the voice recording thing, that's more enticing.
Cause
I might not be good looking enough for the photos, but maybe I could do voice stuff.
Yeah, you got a good voice.
All right, some job opportunities for me.
Yes. You make a lot too. You can make at least as good as a one-on-one tutor in the city. You know, hundreds of kwai for just a couple hours of work, so.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going for it.
Yeah, look into it.
All right. Well, have you done much travel around China?
Around China, my big one was this January. I went to Xi'an by overnight train, and then I took a plane down to Kunming and spent 2.5 weeks in Yunnan. I was mainly hitting up the places that everybody's heard of, but went up to Lijiang, Dali, did the Tiger Leaping Gorge trek, and then I went further south, down into the rice terraces south of Kunming, which was a little more off the beaten path and like, oh, so great, so beautiful.
And what month was it?
That was in January.
Oh, was there any rice?
No, it's a great time to go because actually the terraces are flooded with water. So it's just like, you know, it's just the time when there's lots of water and it's sitting kind of, you know, waiting for hotter. It's not so cold, but you know. But yeah, it's beautiful. It's gorgeous. The light at sunrise and sunset is hitting the water, reflecting in such a beautiful way. So yeah, that was.
Sounds cool.
I've
seen the pictures. I guess I've seen some of that in Vietnam too, the big rice terraces.
Yeah.
But I haven't been to any of the like super famous ones, like the, what do they call it? Dragon's Backbone, I think.
I don't know.
There's one near Guilin somewhere.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm sure they all kind of look the same, right?
Sure. Yeah, probably.
But that might be worth going. And this winter, we're looking for somewhere to go during Christmas break.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't go home.
I think it's a perfect time to get over there. The weather's really nice.
Yeah, it's still warm there.
Yeah.
Right.
Great to get away from Beijing. Cold.
Yeah, totally.
Visit someplace like that.
What about Tiger Leaping Gorge? How was that?
That was cool, yeah. Yeah, it was really neat. It just took about 2 days to hike it, and I went from Lijiang, took a bus, and I was just a single lady, like, going about visiting Yunnan, and the Tiger Leaping Gorge trek was so fun because a ton of people are there from all over the world. I guess not a ton, but, like, I ended up, grabbing a couple tourists from France, from Italy, from Germany, from Scotland, and, like, we were all just going on the same day, like, found each other on the while we were hiking, and so we were like, oh, let's all stay together at this hostel, and you know, played games, like ate and drank together, and did the next day hike together. So it's kind of cool, yeah, like form a little community as you're walking along it.
Yeah, but, sounds good.
But I got to the end, And I just had heard about Tiger Leaping Gorge and that it's amazing, but I don't want to, like, look up pictures and spoil it for myself.
Yeah.
So when I got to the actual rock that's supposed to be, like, a tiger leaping out of the water, yeah, it's just a boulder. It doesn't resemble a tiger at all, and I was so confused.
Just I thought it was, like, a real tiger supposedly jumped over.
Oh, well, that's the myth. It's like, there was a tiger that jumped over the water, and it, like, because of that, became immortalized in stone.
And he turned into stone.
It turned into stone. Okay. But it's just a boulder that's sticking out of the water. Pretty, but it's hard. The hardest part of the hike is just when you're going from the road down to the boulder and then you have to come back up. It was a hot, hot day, and it was cool. It was cool. It was worth it, but
okay.
Yeah, there were just a couple points on the whole hike that were tough, and other than that, it was pretty easy walking, so...
Yeah, well, if there's a hostel for you to stay in the middle, it sounds like it can't be too bad.
Yeah, there were several hostels, yeah.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we'll go do that.
Yeah, no, I would recommend it. It was so pretty. Really good time of the year to visit. But the year before, January before, I was up in Harbing...
Oh, yeah.
For the Ice Sculpture Festival.
Right, yeah.
So I preferred Yunnan, it's a little more comfortable.
Oh, you like it better? Oh, you like the warm weather.
Yes, I do. But I'm pretty proud that I survived Harbing.
You should explain Harbing to...
I will, yeah. So Harbing is in northeast China. And, it's pretty, pretty close to the border, practically Siberia. But it's really famous for an annual snow and ice sculpture festival. And so artists from all over come and they carve these beautiful and enormous sculptures. There was this one huge sculpture all in ice. We climbed up these stairs, got up to the top, and it was a big slide down into a pile of snow. So it's they're big. It was the entering the year of the ram, so there were lots of sheep carved out of ice just really impressive things. And then at night they light them up with bright colors of light, and so it's pretty neat.
Yeah. Katie and I went last winter.
You did?
Yeah, cool. And the theme for the year for us was famous buildings from around the world, and so they had the Kremlin. And they had the Blue Mosque, and they had a lot of stuff from China, a lot of big temples. I forget what else they had. They had some other really famous buildings, though. I think they might have the Taj Mahal, and all carved out of ice. Yeah, and the nighttime is the best. It's they have... I think they have, rope lights, the LEDs that are on ropes, actually inside the ice, iced in. And then they also have floodlights lighting them up, so it's really bright and kind of trippy.
Yeah.
Colorful.
Totally. No, yeah. But yeah, you have to be prepared if you're going to stay out until it closes. I think I was the best prepared of my group. One of my friends just wore, I think, jeans and then, two layers of, what's that called?
Long johns.
Long johns.
Long underwear kind of thing.
Yeah. But it was dude, it's cold.
It's serious. Seriously cold there.
You can't just wear, normal shoes. I think he had a couple layers of socks and normal shoes.
Yeah,
he thought he was stronger than the Harbing cold, but...
This is, I'm from Wisconsin, and it gets way colder in Harbing. It's Siberia. I mean, if you look at the map, it's almost the same level as Lake Baikal.
Oh.
So it's really interesting how diverse in climate China is. It can be, minus 40 degrees up in Harbin on a really cold day. And then down south in Hainan, it's tropical. So it's, in Fahrenheit, it might be, 80, 85 degrees.
Yeah, it's wild.
Giant difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just a huge, diverse country.
Yeah.
Cool. I just, when you're talking about the... tiger? I just want to come back to that. Have you been to Zhangjiajie?
No, I've That's the extent. I also have been to Xi'an, but like that's the extent of my travels in China, unfortunately. So
do you know Zhengzhejie?
Maybe. Describe it a little. Well, I might have heard about it.
It's the Avatar Mountain.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So it's like supposedly the movie Avatar was based on this mountain. Yeah. Or not the movie, but the floating mountains in Avatar, the Hallelujah floating mountains. And so they actually named part of Zhengzhejie, they actually call it the Avatar Hallelujah Mountain or something like that. And it's kind of corny. There's like big figures from the movie, like the birds from the movie that you can pose with, like statues. But the natural formations are amazing. It's like these giant 1,000-foot-high columns of rock with trees on them, and there's dozens of these things in a row, like dotting this valley. And I've just never seen anything else like it. But the reason I bring it up is because there's a lot of these rock formations that they come up with like really colorful names for, and it's like man walking with elephant, and I wish I could even remember most of them, but there's some really crazy names.
Yeah.
And you have to use your imagination a lot to figure these things out.
That's so cool. Yeah. I love that. I love all of the like Chinese names for places. For temples, for rivers, ponds, and then the English translations that sound so oddly poetic. It's great.
Yeah, sometimes the translations are weird, or like sometimes they come up with a totally different word for it, which kind of makes it easier. But I like the I'm old school. I like the direct translation of names. I think that's pretty cool.
For sure, yeah.
I'm sure it sounds just as weird in Chinese when we translate some of our places into English.
Mm-hmm.
Or from English to Chinese.
From Chinese, yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's just a cool thing with the language.
Yeah. When you travel in China, are you using Chinese the whole time?
Oh, like, pretty much.
Yeah.
And not many people speak English in China. That said, I wouldn't discourage you from coming here if you don't speak any Chinese. It might be a little more limiting.
Mm.
Not limiting in where you can go. You're always going to figure things out. Like, you can figure out what a hotel looks like. That's easy enough. And you can always do pantomiming and get in a taxi and tell them something. But maybe traveling around would be hard. Or, like, you're not going to interact with the locals very much if you don't know the language.
Right. And that's always been something that's frustrated me. I wish I could talk more with people.
Yeah,
I can ask basic things and say some basic things, but like when I was in Xi'an and I got on a bus to go to my couch surfer's apartment, and I just wasn't sure about where to get off, so I was able to ask someone who was sitting next to me, and then this old man is like, oh, my friend, and like he continues to talk to me for at least half an hour, and I wish I understood more and could interact with him more. For the most part, no. They were every once in a while. And, like, I'm at the point where I understand words, just not the meaning of the whole sentence. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all you need. Like, that's kind of this misconception with language study, is that, like, you have to somehow understand every word that's being spoken.
Yeah.
And a ton of language, of any language, even English, you can pick up through context.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
If it's your own language.
Yeah.
And you might not hear every word, but if you can just pick up the important ones.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And with the Chinese language, they don't have articles. And so they kind of don't even use a lot of unimportant words. It's like you don't even have to listen for which words are important, because they kind of all are like nouns or verbs. And, right? And so, yeah, it's really weird. It's a really weird feeling when I know what someone else is saying, but I didn't understand any of it. But I know exactly what they're saying.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how I get by on a day-to-day, is like, I might not even fully have heard what they say. It's not just my lack of Chinese, but like, I know this is when they ask me if I want a bag. And so I can say express then that like, no, I don't need a bag, and I'm right. And like, if someone's in the elevator with me, I don't even have to listen to what they say, but they probably ask like, where are you from, or like, what's your nationality?
Yeah.
Like, I just, you know, it's true. Yeah, you can really figure out so much just based on context.
Except once I was in a taxi, and the guy, like, with someone who spoke really good Chinese, and the taxi driver asked me I spoke a couple words to him, and he said, "Oh, your Chinese is really good." And I said back to him, "Oh, I'm American." Because I just assumed he was asking me where I was from, because that's what they all do.
That's funny.
I guess my Chinese isn't so good.
Yeah.
But yeah. I remember recently I was at the Taj Mahal, and like most people in India speak at least a passable English. Like, mm-hmm. English is really widely spoken there. But at the Taj, people come from all over the place to visit, from all over the world and all over India. And part of it, they make you put on these like red slippers or over your shoes to protect the marble when you're walking on it. So we walked over the marble part with the red slippers on, and then left that area, and there was a trash can right there, so we threw out our slippers, and then we followed the sidewalk up to the next part of the Taj, and then there was a big sign that said, "Please put on your slippers now." And I was like, "Ah, fuck, I just threw out my slippers. Why'd you put the sign, or why'd you put the garbage can back there?" And then right behind me, someone else walked up and went like, and I looked out and they didn't have their slippers either. And I knew exactly what they said. And I realized, if you want to learn that exact phrase in like 100 different languages, you just have to stand right next to this sign all day and just listen to what they say. It's a great way to study a phrase.
That's hilarious. Oh, that's so good. But yeah, I mean, when you're traveling, if you are motivated to pick up some of the language, you totally can. I was pretty impressed with a couple of Italians who stayed here while you guys were gone, and I was hosting so many couch surfers. This Italian couple said that they would just go into restaurants that didn't have pictures, and they would point and order things, but they paid attention to what came out.
Okay.
So they would pay attention, like, okay, here's this heading, and here's this list, and then here's this heading, and here's this list. So we ordered things, and we got a noodle dish, and we got a soup. So this probably means noodles and or soup, and this probably means noodles or soup. And they repeated the experiment again and again until they could figure it out based on the characters. So, gosh, like...
that's a good one.
It's a slow way to learn, but yeah. I was so impressed by... they were motivated and they thought it was really interesting to work through Chinese characters like they were deciphering a puzzle. It's very cool.
It is. It's been really fun for me to study the characters as well as the spoken language. Mm-hmm. And I think when I first came here, I had started to study the spoken language a little bit at home, so I knew like the basics, but I didn't know any characters at all. I just thought, I'm just not going to learn those. Mm-hmm. But no, they're like cool and important to learn too. Mm-hmm. I think you'll hit like a wall with your language study if you don't know the characters. But restaurants especially are important because, like, don't let this scare you or anything if you're thinking about coming to China. There's plenty of restaurants with English on the menu.
Or just photos.
Or just
so you
pictures.
Can like look and be like, well, that looks generally acceptable. Like
yeah, except when Katie and I when we first came here, we went into this little restaurant. And there was a picture on the wall, or a few pictures of dishes on the wall.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, that looks like mushrooms on, like, pasta. We're like, yeah, let's get that one. So we pointed at that picture, not knowing what the characters meant at all. And it came out, and, like, I could just smell it right away. It was intestines. It was, like, pig intestines.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, man, we got guts. And Katie just, like, refused to eat any of it. And I was like, but this is probably, like, we don't want to offend them. I want to eat a little bit at least. And, it's kind of like, it's just really hard. It's not that bad tasting. It's just the texture is so awful. It's really hard to chew. And you're kind of swallowing, like, whole chunks of intestines. And then they're, like, passing through your intestines.
Oh, God.
And,
yeah, I feel like it's more just thinking about what it is that you're eating that would be a barrier.
Yeah.
Although I've never tried intestines. I've never had that opportunity.
Try it once. Yeah.
I'll try it. I really want to try tongue.
Tongue.
Yeah. Various animals.
Yeah. That would be interesting.
Yeah. You've never had tongue?
I've never had tongue.
No.
The innards tend to be pretty tough, though.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, then we got the bill, and the whole menu was written in Chinese on the wall, and everything was like 12 to 15 kwai, every single item. So that's what we expected, and this one thing costs like 35, And we're like, what? Why is it so much? And then we realize, oh, it's because it's like a delicacy. They took a picture of it and put it on their wall, and it's going to be the most expensive thing. And
thank goodness it was only 35 and it wasn't like 150.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Another one really fancy thing.
That's like $5 or $6. It's not like a ton of money, but...
Totally, yeah. That is funny.
But that's what motivated me to start learning the menu. So I just went to a couple local restaurants and grabbed a menu and just started entering all the characters into my phone to study later as flashcards.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess it's a good benefit of living here. You can study all the time if you want.
Sure.
Like, there's no limit to the amount of time you can put in studying the language.
Yeah, I should show you. I have a menu of a little, like, noodle rice, like, you know, not fancy restaurant out by where I work.
Yeah.
And a huge perk of working for this company was just that they were really careful about, you know, lunch was a big deal for us. So they took that menu from that restaurant and they translated everything and then wrote in the pinyin for us so that we could not only, like, you know what it was, like, this Chinese, like, I'll get this dish, but also try to practice saying it and ordering it for ourselves. So it's been super helpful even. I've taken that into different restaurants and, like, pointed to the Chinese characters and said, to the best of my ability, using the pinyin, the dish, and just to be like, do you have this? You know?
Okay.
So that's been super helpful. But yeah, it's really, I don't know, for some reason, prior to having tools like that, like, I didn't go out of my way to find them, and I've, yeah, found it harder. But this summer, it's been awesome, like, trying new things.
Yeah, it's so convenient, too, like, living where we do, where we just walk outside, and there's, like, six restaurants in a row on this one block where they all have pretty good food. I wouldn't say any of them are amazing, but they're all, like, good, and they're all really cheap, and none of them have a word of English.
Totally, yeah.
So it's like, it's what better place to learn the language than in that kind of setting.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's like as long as you see what the price is, you know, as long as you fail, or if you do fail and you get something you don't like, it's only going to cost you, like, 12 kwai, or, like, a couple dollars.
Right.
So it's not a huge loss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas if you go to a more touristy part of town, yeah, the prices can really go up. It can get more expensive than at home, even. And it's like, for the exact same food that you're going to get in these hole-in-the-wall places.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's definitely been a highlight for me in general, is just eating the food in China. There's just so much good food here.
Yeah, it's probably what I'm going to be saddest about. I'm hopeful that over in the Seattle area, like, I know that there's a large Chinese community, so I just have to find the good restaurants. So I can get my Chinese food fix, but in my small town in Eastern Washington, there's nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, Panda Express, like, for Chinese food.
Right. God, for the longest time, I thought they actually served panda at the Panda Express. I'm like, why would they serve panda there?
That's awful.
Yeah, it's awful. And I guess it's just a Chinese place, huh? Because, I don't know, I guess we just don't have those where I'm from, or never had them when I was growing up.
Yeah.
But,
huh. That's goofy. Okay, well, we've talked a lot about Asia travel, or at least China travel.
Yeah.
Have you traveled much in Europe? I'm curious.
Oh, a little bit.
A little bit?
Let's see. I got kind of... So I traveled a few times to Mexico when I was, like, in high school and college. And then my first trip to Europe was... It was actually right after September 11th.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, like, 3 weeks later.
Mm.
And it did... But we only... I went with a tour. It's the only time I've gone with, like, a package tour. Or almost the only time. And we went just to London and then did a circle around Ireland.
Mm.
And that was... It was fun, but we didn't meet a lot of people, and I kind of realized that that's not really what I want to do. So then I did another trip, like, a year or two later to mainland Europe, but again, just for, like, 3 weeks, because I used all my vacation time from 1 year and then half from the next year to do this trip, and it was this grand trip, and I saw, like, a lot of big highlights. I saw the Eiffel Tower and the Colosseum and things like that, but something was missing still. And that's kind of where I decided, like, I just really, travel is, this is just not how I want to travel. I don't want to just run around seeing these big landmarks and not dig any deeper. So that's when I decided to just really save my money and do it right and, like, just quit my job entirely and just travel for as long as I can on whatever money I have. So that's kind of the extent of my European travel. Last summer, Katie and I went to Berlin, too. But just to Berlin to visit her old friends.
Okay.
And we stayed there for, like, 2 weeks, so I really got to know Berlin pretty well.
Nice, yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like that's... I mean, that alone, if you go to one place and you stay there longer...
Yeah.
Really get a feel for it as if you live there. Like, I like couch surfing a lot, but also just Airbnb. Like, if you want to, like... experience having your own apartment in a city for 2 or more weeks and, like, get a good vibe for it. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, I've never done Airbnb. A lot of people I know obviously have, but
I've never
actually tried it. I don't know. I'm a really cheap guy.
Sure.
I like staying for free. I like couchsurfing.
Yeah, I've done Airbnb when there were, like, 6 or more of us traveling together.
Yeah.
So couchsurfing's a little harder.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Then the only real option is going to be some college kid and just, like, sleep in his basement or something.
Exactly, yeah. Like, my living room floor is yours.
Right.
I remember traveling when I was 14 to Mexico.
Yeah.
And, you know, my family, like, had... got a little timeshare situation in a resort town and sat on the beach and got cocktails. And, you know, that was, like, even at 14, I kind of felt like, this is wrong. There's so much more to Mexico. And all I'm doing is laying on the beach and, like, people who live here are, like, serving me. Like,
yeah.
I feel very bad about this.
Yeah.
When I was 16, I did a tour thing with a school group. So that was, you know, still not perfect, but we went over, like, with my French teacher, just France, for 2 weeks.
Oh, okay.
And various friends and parents. And, like, at least when we got to a town, they would tell us, like, all right, you have 3 hours, go explore. Like, we'll meet you back here. And that was... great, like, traveling for the first time in a foreign country where I spoke the language at least a little bit, and I was doing things with friends. That opened my eyes. And so, yeah, after that, it was really, like, I went to study abroad, and then I went to work there, and I'd take short trips on weekends and on vacations, but yeah, I really like that, living abroad and just, like, making the most of your home base abroad. To, like, either, you know, just make every weekend all your spare time, like it's travel, even if it's in the city that you live in, but...
You can always explore your own town, then.
Yeah.
I guess even at home you can do that, but it's cool when you're in a foreign country, too.
True, yeah.
Kind of part of the reason I started this podcast is just to show people that there's not one way to do it.
Yeah.
Like what you described in Mexico, if you have... a really stressful job and you're working like 80 hours a week and you can take exactly 1 week off a year to just relax, I totally get it that you just want to go to the beach and drink Mai Tais and, like, just hang out. But that's not the only way to do it. And like, there's other ways, like living somewhere or like I've done and just taking a couple of years off and never really had a home, just travel. Travel isn't just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say for you, what works best? Is it living somewhere? Is that what you think?
I think so. And, like, you know, I'm still actually debating that exact point because it's been harder, obviously, like, living in China than it was living in France. And so my time here, you know, just being in Beijing has been enough, and I took that one trip to Yunnan, and I was wiped by the end from the exertion of really speaking Chinese and like, you know, being by myself and as a traveler. I've almost always done that. I've almost always just been solo girl, like, making my way, 'cause, you know, most people that I'm close with, like, they support travel, but, you know, they're doing school or they're doing work, and they don't...
Sure, yeah.
They're not taking time off, so...
Yeah, I've learned you gotta travel with people who, if you're gonna travel with somebody else, they've gotta have the same budget as you.
Yeah.
And they've gotta have the same time
frame
as you.
It's
and
much
the same
harder.
Kind of outlook as you.
Totally.
Or you're just not gonna get along.
Yeah. Because I like to travel cheaply.
Yeah.
And you know, like I did a 2.5 month road trip across the US, sort of made a rectangle of it, so I saw the two coasts and then the most north and most south. And I would eat like some oatmeal for breakfast and like some nuts and an apple for lunch and then have a full on dinner. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, I think a lot of people think of travel as, you know, you're paying for a hotel every night. You're paying for flights or like other more expensive, comfortable transportation. And you're paying for 3 nice meals out in restaurants every day. And like,
yeah.
I would never have been able to afford that before, but I like this way. I like just kind of, you know, it's still awesome to be eating like one awesome authentic meal in a new place, like local cuisine every day, but then, you know, I'm not breaking my bank either.
Yeah, it's just one meal then.
One meal, and I can really feel like no guilt about having a beer or two and... Just, I don't know. I like that. I like couch surfing as I go and staying with local people or at least meeting up with local people as much as I can. From that road trip, like, I would go back to any of the places I went to, not necessarily because of the place, but because of the people who hosted me.
Sure.
So, yeah, I love that. I love making it about people and about, like, trying as much as I can, however long I'm there, to get a feel for, like, what you would do, like, what your average, like weekend evening would be like in this place. And I do a little bit of the tourist stuff, too, of course, but also just get a sense for, like, what it's like in the parks, what it's like, you know, in the, like, less touristy neighborhoods. So that's my way for travel. And then, it's nice to have a home base, I think, if you're going to go explore Europe or go explore Asia. Like, have a home base and visit on the side. It becomes also just a lot more manageable, like, money-wise. You know?
Yeah.
Financially, like, if you're working and then you're just doing a weekend trip, it's not such a big deal.
Yeah, and just in general, the slower you go, the less you're going to spend, mm-hmm. like, per day. Although, I guess if you're bicycling, that's maybe like one of the cheapest forms of travel.
Yeah.
And then you're going pretty fast. You can go upwards of 100 miles in a day, which is pretty good, really.
Mm-hmm.
But your only expense really is food.
Yes.
So
yeah. Have you ever traveled that way?
Not for a long trip. So I'm kind of just thinking about it.
I've met
a lot of cycle tourists in the last couple of years, and they all. None of them started with cycle touring, and they've all kind of gotten into it, and they all love it. So that might be the way to go for me.
That's super cool,
in the future.
One of my college friends, he lived for a year in Ireland just doing odd jobs, and then went down south and down, like, to France and Italy, and then went eastward and, like, continued. It was, you know, kind of tracing the origins of wine, and that was sort of a theme of his travels, was like exploring wine production and wine culture. But I mean, I think he mainly was just paying for food. You have to eat a lot if you're cycling that much. He would either camp or like couch surf, or even just be like, oh, this beach looks good, I'm like falling asleep right now.
There's always that. There's always just waiting until the sun goes down and then just like sneak into a field or a forest and pitch a tent. And
right.
I've certainly done that.
Yeah.
Like Katie and I did that trip up to Inner Mongolia, and mm-hmm. we just hired a taxi driver to drive us out into this forest and just told her, okay, we'll be at this exact spot in 2 days. Just come pick us up. Mm-hmm. And we just walked into the forest.
So cool.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's a good way to do it. It's cool when you have things like a tent. You know, if you go online and read, like, things you should never take traveling, it's like, all the stuff I have is on that list. Like, never take a tent. It's like, no, man, I always use a tent. You know, I've kind of been brainstorming this idea. Maybe I'll do, like, I don't know, another podcast or, like, write an article about it. But I think, for me, the best way to determine what you should take on any trip is, if you think you're probably going to use it, just take it. And if you're not using it after, like, a month, just send it home. Or throw it, if it's not valuable, just give it away. And most things you can buy on the road, but some things you can't. And I still have to work out all the details of this exact plan, but it's like, I don't think you should worry so much about what you're going to take, because it's going to work itself out.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah, my tent is invaluable to me. I love having a tent, because I never feel anxious about where I'm going to stay. I'm not like, if I don't have a tent, I'm not going to go hitchhiking at like 4 p.m., because I might not find a ride, and I'll just get stuck out in the middle of nowhere.
Sure.
But if I have a tent, it actually opens up opportunities. I can do that. I can sleep wherever I want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I have a stove, I can make my food wherever I want.
Yeah,
so I carry
a
stove with me.
That does expand your possibilities. I'm going on a road trip along the West Coast when I get back home in, like, 4 days. Woo! Mm. And I was thinking that, too, like, I love couch surfing, but it brings on this level of anxiety. You have to be where you say you're going to be.
Oh, yeah.
When you say you're going to be there. And you also have to just, like, work hard and, like, hope that you can find a host and it's a good experience. But yeah, I really wanted to go the camping route and just maybe not even plan, just, like, see how far we drive that day and, like, find a spot we can be. But my brother was a little anxious about it, so we have spots reserved at campgrounds.
Oh, okay.
But we're at least, like, we'll have flexibility of time, you know. I won't have to worry about being rude if we're late, you know.
Yeah, so that's awesome. It's kind of like almost one of the downsides of the internet, I think, is this whole reservation thing. It kind of gets at me, because even like 10 years ago when I was traveling in South America, no one ever reserved a room or a bed in a hostel beforehand. There weren't like these websites where you can reserve them.
Sure.
So everyone just showed up, and I only had like once where I couldn't find somewhere. Like in 1,000, like my book's 1,000 Days Between, and in 1,000 days of travel, like one night that I can remember where I had a very difficult time finding a place to stay. So it was so uncommon back then. And that's not that long ago. And now it's like, just because you can't, like, you're able to reserve online for anything, like a hostel, for a hotel, it's very easy to do. You don't have to make a phone call or anything. You don't have to speak the foreign language. You just pay the money. And it just seems like everyone's doing that now. And for that reason, the hostels get all full. And then it's hard to just be spontaneous and show up. I don't want to sound like a grouchy old man too much, but that's kind of one of my complaints, is like, it's taken away the spontaneity.
Yeah. No, but that is, things have changed so much in 10, 20 years. Like, it's funny to reflect on, like, when we were growing up, like, the internet was just becoming a thing, right? Like,
well, there was no internet.
Yeah, well,
we didn't have it at all.
When did the internet become a thing? Like,
I started using it in 96.
Yeah, yeah. So,
which is when I was in college. Like, I'm older than you, so.
Okay. I was born in 91, so yeah, it was like,
Oh, wow, you're young.
But I don't feel like it when I'm talking to my students who are like 10 to 14.
Okay.
And I'm like, you don't even know. Like, when I was a kid, like, the internet was just becoming a thing, and now you're like so addicted to your little smartphone. Like, think about how it was then.
But when you were 5, people were starting to get email addresses, and like like a large percentage of Americans were getting online.
Right, yeah.
And that was when I was 18. So when I was in high school, no one had a cell phone. They just didn't exist. Sure. There was no internet.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of that last generation, like the youngest person who can say that. Like, I totally grew up with no internet, and like anyone younger than me, it's just almost hard to relate to that to that experience.
Because
the internet is such a huge game changer, and almost all of it's positive. I love the internet. I absolutely love it, but there's just some downsides to it.
Sure, yeah.
That still kind of get to me.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's so funny. My mom, I remember, we were just talking while I was home recently about the internet and cell phones and yada yada technology. And she was saying that back in the day, back in the 90s, she was so against email addresses, and, you know, she was adamant that, I am not going to get an email address if someone can't pick up the phone, like the landline phone, and call me, then they don't want to talk to me.
Right, right.
And now, you know, she was the first person in my family to have, like, a BlackBerry and, like, is sending emails constantly for her work.
Yeah,
and,
so she adapted.
Like, yeah, she adapted. She had to, because,
you know.
But when something first becomes a thing, it's so easy to be against it. Like,
oh, very much.
Yeah.
There's this story where one of the big brokerages for buying stocks, I don't know the exact one, it might have been Schwab, they made an announcement in, like, 1998, we will never allow online stock purchases. Mm-hmm. And I forget the exact company, but they made a big deal of it. Like, we're never going to have an online system, so stop asking. You have to call in to purchase stock through us. And it was like 6 months before they caved after making that statement and said, okay, we'll do online. Because, like, they just couldn't survive as a company without doing it. So it was like a big mistake that they made. And they realized they had to adapt.
Sure.
Anyway, I see you're kind of looking at the time.
Well, I know.
We've gone, we've definitely gone over an hour here. But it just goes by fast.
It's fun to chat.
It's been an awesome conversation.
Yeah.
We're talking about a website that you have. Do you want to give people the name of it? And I'll put up a link. If you want to check out your pictures or...
Yeah, I don't... It's through... I have a couple of things. I have a blog that's alachinoise.wordpress.com. A la chinoise is French for, like, in the Chinese way. Okay. So I started that when I first came over from France to China, and I was like, adjusting from, like, trying to fit in France to trying to fit in here in Beijing. And I stopped that about a year ago, but it's still pretty interesting about, like, my early impressions of
life. Oh, so it's still useful, life. Then.
Yeah, life in Beijing, like, life in China, my travels, like, food, cultural differences. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. And then I put together a portfolio through a company called Pathbrain. So that has, like, a lot of my reflections on travel and language learning and, like, trials of working for a Chinese company and lots of things, so...
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll put up links to both of those if you get them to me.
Cool.
And thanks for chatting with me. It's been a great time.
Sure. Thank you, Dan.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. For more information, you can visit my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. From there, you can sign up to get updates from this podcast delivered directly to your inbox. Remember, the Around the World podcast is all about meeting ordinary people who have done extraordinary things. Thanks for listening.